Good morning. Okay, so hopefully you're here for operating systems. Hopefully you're here for section two, which is the earlier one because we make schedules in the wrong order. So there are two sections of this course. There's mine at this time and Grimshaw's at 11 in Rice. We'll share probably some TAs. We're going to share large parts, possibly all of assignments and quizzes, but there will be differences. The assignment requirements are probably going to be slightly different, and I don't guarantee that like our quizzes will be the same. Like if I cover something that Grimshaw doesn't or vice versa, we might ask different questions and so on. So just a warning. There is a webpage for this course, for this section. It's linked off Colab, so you don't need to copy down that URL, but you're welcome to do so. So this course is going to have programming assignments. In fact, probably more than by count of assignments by prior semesters of operating systems. They are mostly in C or C++, meaning you choose for some of them, and for some of them, we're giving you something that's written in C, so you're probably going to have to use C. I recommend C++ when you have a choice, but you're welcome to use C if you prefer. There will be 1 to 2 week assignments. If it's 2 weeks, there's going to be a checkpoint. Some starting work you have to submit that won't be worth very much, just to make sure that you aren't deciding that every assignment needs to be started 48 hours before it's due, which is a bad idea, a really, really bad idea for some of these assignments. The schedule that's posted right now is a bit aggressive. In particular, depending on how much we get to this week, I might need to push back all the assignments before the midterm by 1 week, which is fine. I'd like to start everything early, and have things be a little more synced up with lecture later on in the semester, but if that doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. So some of the assignments are going to be using an operating system called XV6. So XV6 is a teaching operating system built by some people at MIT. It's based on an old version of Unix. And theoretically, you can compile it and actually boot it on real 32-bit x86 hardware. We're not going to do that. We're going to use an emulator. It even supports multi-core in theory, if you can find some 32-bit x86 machine to boot. But that's what we're going to be using. Also going to be talking about it a lot in lecture because I like having examples of real operating systems that, you know, where I can show actual code and not just talk about, these are ways you could do things. We'll do a lot of talking about these are ways you could do things, but it's good to have a concrete example. So there will also be some quizzes online after the week of each lecture, starting not this week, but next week, so people who add the course aren't totally confused and I don't have to make 500 exceptions. It's the same interface as 3330, but there will be no time limit. And this will just be on things we covered in lecture that you should know from the lecture. Like in 3330, it's open notes, open book, open internet, please do not IM people asking for answers, please do not ask in Stack Overflow, etc. There will be exams, there will be one midterm and one final. The midterm date is posted. If you can't make that, please let us know soon. We'll figure something out. Same thing for the final, though hopefully you thought about that earlier, if that's a problem for you. So, textbook. There is a recommended, not required, but recommended textbook, which is this textbook, Operating Systems Principles and Practice by Anderson and Dahlin. If you want other resources, you might also try what has historically been the textbook for this course, which is fine, which is Silver Shirts, Operating System Concepts. There's some other versions which are similar. For some things later in the semester that aren't covered in Anderson and Dahlin, we might be using this book, which is available legally as a PDF online. And I've considered using it as the main textbook, but it's a bit terse in parts. Okay, and standard academic honesty thing. Don't cheat on homeworks. Homeworks are individual. This means that you shouldn't be using code from prior semesters. You shouldn't be sharing code, pseudocode, descriptions of your code. that are kind of like pseudocode and so on shouldn't be like having your friend look at your code to debug it. You shouldn't use code from the internet with extremely limited exceptions. So which exceptions are like a line of code to solve something which isn't the point of the assignment and it's really clear it's not. Like if the assignment has nothing to do with string parsing, maybe getting a line of string parsing code is okay, you should still cite it. And if the assignment write-up says, hey, you can find one of these somewhere and use it, you can do that. We'll be case that later semester. If you're in doubt, ask. We'll be glad to answer about what you can and can't do. The quiz is also individual. As I said, don't share answers, don't IM people for answers, don't ask on Stack Overflow, and so on. And for getting help, some TAs and possibly me will man Piazza. There will be office hours, which will be posted soon by the end of this week when everyone figures out what times they actually have free. And you can email me. Probably you should try other things first, but if it's something that's personal, probably emailing me or a private post on Piazza is the way. Some TAs will be writing a refresher on C and C++, because since for some of you, you did this in 2150 and 3330, like 2 years ago, and have now forgotten all about it, and you know, you'll need to write code that uses pointers, you might need to do that. So this is totally optional. There will probably be two sessions of it. Probably the first will be Thursday. We will have announcements first coming. Okay, so that's all my logistics stuff. So are there any questions on logistics before I move on? Yes?
What should people on the wait list be expecting?
So what should people on the wait list be expecting? There will probably be some attrition, and the wait list isn't that big. But generally, because I don't want people choosing this section for the purpose of deciding who do they think is going to grade more harshly, if you want to be accepted off the wait list, you should tell me why you can't make the other section. And if you have a good reason, you know, like you're graduating soon and there's an elective you want to take at that time, that probably will work out. Okay, so let's talk about operating systems. That's theoretically what this course is about. And we're going to first talk about a bunch of opinions about what an operating system is. In one view, the operating system is this layer of software that we use to access the hardware. That the operating system's going to abstract that hardware. It's going to provide some sort of protected access to a bunch of shared resources. We have a bunch of applications that we want to run at the same time, and the operating system is going to handle coordinating access to that shared hardware for all those applications, let those applications cooperate in how they use that hardware when they need to. So it's coordinating these things. Another way of viewing things is that historically, there used to be a job called the computer operator. So here are some computer operators. And they're doing things like, there's a bunch of tapes over there. They need to take them in and out. They need to set programs to run. And you know, these are all things that these days operating systems automate more. It's like getting storage where you need it, starting programs running, and so on. And you can think of it as taking over more and more of this job of, so where previously we have someone physically in front of the controls, like moving the data where it needs to be, inputting the program physically to make it start, and so on. So that's one view, is that it's coordinating access to this shared hardware and coordinating these multiple programs running. Another view is that it's really just about convenience, is that if we wanted to, we could just write programs that ran directly on the hardware, but that's really annoying. We don't really want to do that. So the operating system's job there is just to provide a more convenient interface. And we'll look at an example of this later, you know, of what this could mean. So that we just don't like the hardware interface. The operating system's giving us a new, more convenient interface that does the same stuff, but it's, you know, less clunky. And we could also think about like these roles, that operating system is lots of things together. So one thing we can say, it's a referee. It's, we have these competing programs and we're trying to make them, you know, cooperate. So it's handling, how do I decide who gets access to the resources that everyone wants? And it's an illusionist. It's deciding, how do I provide clean abstractions for this really ugly hardware? Like there's 50 different types of disks, how do I make them all look like the same thing? And it's this glue, it provides these common services that, lots of programs need, like storage, organizing the storage, and windowing systems, and authorization, and networking, things that lots of programs need and don't want to have to do themselves. And so these are all different, all these, three slides, someone might say, is the definition of an operating system. That's exactly what it is. This combination of stuff, or it's just this layer of software that's for convenience, or it's just this layer of software that's because you have multiple competing programs, or it's all these things together. You'll hear all these definitions. There's no consensus on what is exactly an operating system. So we're gonna kind of do things where it's, in that area. And there are some commonalities here. Like all these things are about hiding some complexity. That when we write applications, there are these hard problems that we're not dealing with when we write applications that we've given to someone else. That applications don't worry about competing applications, either because the operating system is the referee between them or because the operating system is this convenience layer to help them cooperate. And they don't worry about varying hardware. Just accidentally, if we think about the operating system just coordinating the hardware, or on purpose, if we think of it as making it a more clean interface. And in all cases, when I'm talking about the operating system, I'm talking about these applications. So the operating system is written for application programmers, people who write normal programs like the type you've written all throughout here. And that's making your life easier, regardless of whether the actual goal, as far as the operating system writer, is to make your life easier, or just like keep you from destroying the other programs on the system. Still ends up making your life easier. Okay. So that's a bunch of disjointed ideas of what an operating system is. And the reason I have that bunch of disjointed ideas is to point out that there's not this one consensus on exactly what the right definition is. You can use any of them, and you're probably about right. So, regardless of what you think about definitions, we can say that an operating system is providing what I'll call a virtual machine interface. And this is kind of weird if we think about how we use an operating system, because we have like files and like print calls, which is not really how machine interfaces, if you think about hardware, works. Maybe you don't know exactly how those interfaces work, but I assure you they're not really like files. And this idea of a virtual machine interface, there's a spectrum of choices of what that interface looks like. And the one that you're most familiar with when I say virtual machine is what we call a system virtual machine. And in this case, we've chosen this virtual interface, so we have these bunch of applications sitting on an operating system, and the virtual interface we've chosen is designed to imitate some real physical hardware. Maybe not the physical hardware we're using, in fact, probably not. But it's designed to imitate physical hardware. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, we've chosen the interface solely based on convenience. We don't care how the hardware really works. We've just chosen what we think is the most useful to the application programmers, and then we've dealt with all the complication of implementing that functionality in that layer we're calling the operating system. And usually we're somewhere in between, that we're gonna make some choices that are based on exposing some physical interfaces, where that might not be the most convenient thing, but we're going to try to be closer to this process virtual machine side of that usually when we choose what functions are we going to provide to applications, that they're chosen for convenience. But all these things you can think of as operating systems. So system virtual machines, the reason we use them is because they run other operating systems. So here, our application is another operating system, so we end up with that instead of an application, we have another OS. And on top of that, applications itself, that we can run another operating system in that model. And that's because they have this interface that imitates some real hardware. But it's still serving an application programmer, it's just that the application programmer there is other operating system programmers. And the abstractions we see on sort of process virtual machines and system versus system virtual machines or real hardware are different, but they serve the same purpose. So we'll have something we'll call a thread, which represents the real hardware idea of processors. We have memory allocation we do in a process VM and real hardware. We have like page tables to manage that type of functionality. On real hardware, you have this disk or this SSD that you talk to with some interface where you send locations and so on, where they look what we call devices. We'll talk more about that much later in the semester. And in a normal process virtual machine model, we have these things called files. But they serve the same purpose. They're for storing data or interacting with the outside world. So we have these matching abstractions. Abstractions for these hardware resources that we've chosen because they're more convenient. So you could build an operating system where instead of adding files, you have things which look like disks, and that's all you provide. But if you were writing programs, you would find that awfully inconvenient. You know, if you wanted to write a word processor for that operating system, probably the first thing you're going to do is re-implement files. Because gosh, it would be inconvenient to have your user select a disk for each file. But it does provide the same functionality. And we've just chosen these abstractions because they're much more useful. But you could imagine maybe you'd have a reason not to do that, to have other abstractions that provide the same functionality. Maybe there's some way other than files to expose storage that would make more sense. So, regardless of what we've chosen as the interface, we view the OS as providing some sort of abstract virtual machine, some sort of fake thing which we can imagine is the hardware. Because as far as the application is concerned, we're sitting here with our application, we look down at the OS's interface, and that's all we see. We can't see through it, we don't know what's going on underneath, and we don't care. So the application's machine, as far as we're concerned, is the operating system. That's what we're programming for. That's what we care about. And we don't have any hardware I/O details visible. So as long as the operating system keeps implementing these interfaces, these abstractions it provides, like files, we're going to still have our application theoretically run fine, 20 years from now when all the hardware works differently. And from this view, the operating system is just a piece of software which is taking commands for one type of abstraction, like files, and converting them to another, like these raw devices, however they want to talk to software. That's just a conversion layer. It's just taking one interface, converting it to another, and just handing it off to the real hardware. And sometimes this job is pretty complicated. And this is because we've chosen convenient interfaces. If the interfaces we provided really look like the raw hardware, this job becomes very easy. Because we can just basically do nothing and just send the command on down to the next interface. But usually that's not the case. And probably the most important example is how we deal with the processor and memory. That usually when we think of an operating system, you just start a program and it pretends it has its processor forever. Every program gets a CPU, and it also gets all its memory. And that somehow just works, even though there's lots of programs running. And we call this abstraction, where a program gets its own CPU and memory, a process. So we have an application running, and it's assigned this thing in the interface called a process. And that process has associated with it some registers and some memory. So we have registers, and when the application's running, that's mapped to the physical CPU. And we have some memory, which is mapped somewhere in this larger pool of memory. And the operating system does the translation to make that happen, to make it so it ends up when you're running, that the thing you set as registers end up on the real CPU, and the thing that you have memory is in the real memory. And if we say have another process running, maybe, you know, it's not on the CPU right now, but it still has registers, and the operating system handles keeping those in memory temporarily. And at some point, it's going to need to do what we call a context switch, that application one stops running on the CPU, maybe because we only have one CPU and we want to run lots of applications. So we need to swap over its registers to memory because we can't fit them on the CPU itself. And so this is where we have this convenient abstraction that you can run as many processes as you want, and that doesn't match the hardware, which can, on this machine, only do one thing at a time. And the operating system is translating to provide that better interface, and it has to do this extra work. And these are the sorts of things we're going to talk about doing for a lot of these abstractions in our operating system, is making things look like a nicer interface. And that means that we're going to have to do bookkeeping and make decisions in order to make that happen with the limited hardware that we're translating these interfaces to. So the other big interface we'll talk about is files. And files are what we're going to use and what typical operating systems use to communicate with everything. You want to talk to the monitor? Use a file. You want to read from a keyboard or mouse? Use a file. You want to talk to the disk or the network? Use a file. So there's this one common interface for these very, very different kinds of devices. Yes?
So are these different from files in the way that we typically think about them, or are they like actual file files?
So the question is, are these different from files in the way that we typically think about them? So that's complicated. So because they're files in the sense that there's this minimal interface we're going to talk about, which is that a file is a bunch of bytes you can read and write. And these all provide that interface. And this particular choice I'm showing here, this is what Unix decided to do. Some OSs don't work this way. So on Unix, there's this thing called a file, which you can open, you can read and write bytes, and all these things have it. They don't provide the same functionality. Like on a network, you can't like seek to the beginning of the network. Like that's not a thing which makes sense on a network, but on a file on disk, yeah, that makes a little more sense. So they're different. But they have this shared interface, which is primarily how we're going to interact, and that's reading and writing them. So the other part of this interface is that some things don't work, and they don't work in a controlled way. So like, if application accesses memory it's not supposed to, it just gets a segmentation fault, rather than something else happening. And this is part of the key goal of making it so that we can run multiple applications aside each other without worrying about it. That we've simplified the interface by making it so all the bad things we could do at least don't do too much bad. Rather than the real hardware, where if you access some random memory location, probably it usually turns out very confusingly bad, well, some large portion of the time. So that's our preview, sort of view of what operating systems look like. And sort of the key abstractions. So I'm going to talk about the first abstraction we're going to really be dealing with, which was processes. And starting with processes, because they're, you know, the first thing we think about when we talk about what operating systems do. They're running applications, and the process is the notion that pretty much every operating system you care about uses to represent an application that's running. So we want to talk about what is a process. So you may have seen these slides in 3330, but same thing. So a process is going to be a thread plus some address space. And a thread is the illusion that you have a CPU. So a thread looks like a processor. A processor has some registers, it has a program counter, and it runs the thing at the program counter and advances the program counter, changing the registers and accessing memory along the way in a loop. A thread provides that to you. And we have an address space, which is the idea that you have something in memory that you've chosen to be there. So you have a memory. And this is the illusion of a dedicated machine because as far as actually doing computation, what we need is a processor and memory. Now, that's not enough to really do work because probably you want to output something or input something at some point. Maybe, you know, you probably just don't want to compute something and have it not go anywhere. But this is the key part for actually doing computation, and a process provides this. Note that I have threads. So we're going to start out by talking about processes as one thread, that there's one CPU you get and a memory. But the general concept, we're going to have potentially multiple threads, that your process has as many cores as it wants, and the operating system's job is to make that work on however many processors you really have. And when we're implementing a process, we're going to want to run them alongside each other and keep them from crashing each other. And there's two big hardware mechanisms which are the most popular way of implementing processes. And therefore the ones we'll talk about. We might briefly talk about some alternatives because these are not, in fact, the only ways to implement processes. These are by far the most popular. So the first mechanism is this concept of dual mode operation. That our processor, the physical hardware, because it wants it to make it possible to implement an operating system efficiently, has chosen to have some little bit of extra state to help operating systems. And that's a notion of a mode. There's either a kernel mode or a user mode. You might see different names for these. I'll try to just use kernel mode and user mode, but you might hear like supervisor mode or privileged mode. They all mean kernel mode. And some operations that the processor does are going to require kernel mode. So things like talking directly to devices should require kernel mode generally. And the idea is the operating system gets to control what runs in kernel mode. We'll talk about exactly how that works later. And by doing that, it controls what can do these privileged operations. And in this way, the operating system can keep some process from like interfering with the disk that the operating system wants another process to be using instead. The second mechanism is address translation. So typically, we're going to have this one real memory. And we're going to have multiple programs loaded in it. So there's going to be different parts of the memory reserved for different programs. And the hardware is going to provide a way for the OS to set a mapping. You might have remembered this as a page table, hopefully. Where whenever program A is running, the hardware is going to use this mapping the OS sets to decide what places in the real memory to access. And since the OS controls what this mapping is, it can decide that anything I don't want the program to access is just going to trigger an error. It's not going to actually access real memory, and it's never going to access, say, the OS's data. And that way, the OS doesn't have to worry about the program like overwriting the OS's data by accident because there was a bad pointer. And it's never going to access the other program's data. Program A has no path to program B. So by setting this up correctly, you know, the OS decides what the memory for each program is, and this implements that address space abstraction. And these are, you know, very common today. Like, you'll have a hard time finding an operating system where this isn't the way it works if it provides isolation between programs. There are some operating systems which don't, where they just said, if your program has a bad pointer, it's gonna mess up the system. We typically don't use those when we can get away with not using them. So this is for every operating system you can think of that isn't like for very, very constrained devices where you can't actually isolate processes from each other, this is what they use. There are some other ways of doing it, which are very interesting, but no one actually seems to use them. So that's sort of implementing processes, the core idea. So we have this idea of protecting processes from each other, but we also need to respond to events. Like, if I press a key, the OS might want to run a different program than the one that's running. Like, it might want to run whatever process needs to read that key press and, you know, I pressed enter and run a command. So it needs some way of doing that. There's also other things, like if a program is just looping on the CPU, the OS might want to give another program a turn eventually. And if it actually has its registers and its program counter on the processor, well, the processor is just going to read the program counter, run the next instruction in that loop, keep going, and we need some other mechanism to make that stop. Like, there's nothing in the loop that's doing it. And so the hardware provides support for doing this, which is exceptions. And we need this hardware support because we've chosen that when we run a process, we're gonna have the processor run the real CPU instructions that process set. We're not gonna filter those instructions to make them do something else. We're gonna run the real ones, and we can't trust them to do this stuff, to stop when a key press happens, to stop after too long. So we're gonna rely on the hardware having support to do that for us. And exceptions are going to interact with this idea of dual mode operation. I said some privileged operations, you know, can only be done in kernel mode. And our rule is going to be that user code always, without exception, runs in user mode. We are never going to run code that applications give us in kernel mode. We're just not going to do it. And OS code is the only code which runs in kernel mode. I'm not saying that all OS code runs in kernel mode, but the only code that runs in kernel mode is OS code, code that the operating system provided. And the processor, on an exception, changes from user to kernel mode. And this is going to help us enforce this rule. So when we start running a user program, we're going to change to user mode, which is going to be some privileged instruction probably. And when an exception happens, the processor is going to change back to kernel mode for us. And it's going to let the OS react however it wants, including doing privileged instructions like talking to that disk. We don't want the whatever process we are running to talk to. And this is usually the only mechanism for doing so. That the only way that we enter kernel mode is with an exception. And typically, because of this, whenever we want the OS to do something for any reason, we're going to end up using an exception to do it, because typically, if we need the OS to do it, we need kernel mode to do it, because we're going to manipulate something that's privileged, something that processes aren't supposed to touch. So you may remember from 3330 that when we talked about exceptions, and if you didn't take 3330, you may have seen some terms for exceptions. Here are the ones we use in 3330, and I think these are useful only to tell you that there are different kinds of exceptions. So we have things triggered by an external event, like a timer or a network packet or a key press. In 3330, we call those interrupts. We have faults, which are what happens when the program does something bad, whatever bad means. Like accessing invalid memory or dividing by zero. We have traps, which are triggered by some explicit action of the program. And we're going to talk about those in a lot of detail in a bit. And the most common example is system calls, where I mentioned we want the operating system to do something. That's how we're going to do it. We're going to explicitly cause the operating system to run using an exception. And we're going to do that because we want it to run in kernel mode, because it needs to do something privileged that we can't do ourselves. And in 3030, they also have this term aborts, which is something in the hardware broke, like the memory stick is broken. So this terminology is not very universal, so I'm not going to test you on it. And in particular, I'm mentioning this because XV6 seems to just use these terms haphazardly, which is just very common. Like, if you pick up some random processor manual, they'll just use whatever words they like. They'll probably be consistent internally, but you basically need to figure out from context when they say trap, do they only mean something like a system call, or do they mean anything? When they say interrupt, do they only mean something that's triggered externally, or do they also mean traps? So they kind of use the term haphazardly. XE6 manuals often use interrupt to mean any kind of exception. In particular, there's an interrupt instruction which triggers a trap, but it's called interrupt, so. Just expect that. And in general, if you need to figure this out, context clues are how you actually figure out what the term is, or hopefully there's a definition section whenever you're reading. So, I mentioned system calls. And system calls we're going to do because we want to access some kernel service. We have those abstractions and we want to use them. Like, we want to allocate memory, we want to change our address space. And that involves setting that mapping I showed you, and we're not going to let programs change their own mapping directly. They're going to have to ask the operating system politely to do it. And the operating system gets to decide, well, do I really want to let you access that memory? If we're reading and writing to a file, we're going to do that through the operating system. Because even if we're supposed to access that hard drive, we don't want to let the program that's writing a file on that hard drive write all the files in that hard drive. The operating system needs to make sure it's only writing things it's supposed to, or reading things it's supposed to. We want to read input from the keyboard. We're going to talk to the operating system, because the operating system is what knows when we've pressed a key, and gets to decide which of the many programs that's running gets to see that key press. So all these are going to need privileged instructions, because we're communicating with devices, we're changing things that we shouldn't let programs just change, because otherwise they'd potentially overwrite things we don't want them to overwrite and break other programs. So all these need to run code in kernel mode. And so we're going to use one of those instructions that deliberately trigger an exception. And this still is going to work like a normal exception. It's going to start executing code chosen by the OS in kernel mode. Just like if you press the key, same thing's going to happen. So these work the same way. And this is how the program requests privileged instructions. And so the typical way this works is that we have some code executing in user mode. And note that I have this listed above as the standard library. So generally, when you write code that needs the OS to do something, you don't actually write something which calls the OS. You write something which calls the standard library. And the standard library has some code which calls the OS. But since this is a library, it's included in your application, and it's part of that thing the OS is running. And you could argue that the standard library is part of the OS, that really the interface is the library calls and not these system calls. Or you could argue the system calls the real interface. And, you know, you could use whatever standard library you like, so why is that really part of the OS? But wherever we put this, this is code that's running as part of that sequence of instructions. The processor is looking at the PC. The next thing to run is this move this value sysread into REX, and so on. So we set some values to tell the operating system, hey, what do I want to do? And in this case, we're saying, hey, we would like to read standard out, apparently, which is a mistake, and we're going to run our system call. So we do these things, and then we have this special instruction which triggers an exception. So we've set up the command we want to give the operating system, and I have this instruction to say, go to the operating system, do a system call, and that triggers an exception. And this is one way on 64-bit x86 of triggering an exception. And this is going to jump to some place in kernel mode. So it's going to run some code in kernel mode, and we're going to know where to go because during boot, the operating system was running, and the operating system set a pointer somewhere saying, this is where you go on the syscall instruction. And the hardware knows to read that pointer. And this handler saves registers, handles the calling convention for these system calls, and does the operation, or in this case says, hey, you can't read from standard out, and returns that result. So all this part runs in user mode. So here, privileged operations are prohibited. And all this part is where we can do privileged operations, like potentially actually, you know, talk to file, read and write from files, and so on. And we have a special instruction to switch into kernel mode and run this thing the OS specified at boot, where it should go. And we have another special instruction to switch back to user mode and go back to some, hopefully, where the syscall was or some other place that the operating system chose. So, questions about this? Yes?
How did it know, like, syscall doesn't take any arguments, how does it know which thing to do?
So how does it know which thing to do? So all these registers are going to be available to the operating system. So it's just going to, so this code here is going to read those registers, and it's going to figure out, what did you want me to do? Did you want me to read? Did you want me to write? And it's going to do that based on that registers. And how those registers are interpreted is entirely up to the operating system. The hardware doesn't care. So the operating system is going to choose some way to identify what operation you want and use that with something like this syscall instruction. Yes? So this syscall instruction here, this is a real 64-bit x86 instruction. It is not a 32-bit x86 instruction, so later on we'll see a different instruction used, but it does the same thing. We just need an instruction which causes an exception to happen. So anyone will do, we just need to have the operating system agree on what instruction it expects you to use, so it knows where it should put its pointer to its syscall handler. So we're going to talk about a Unix-like operating system, and in most of this class, we're going to look at the Unix operating system design. And some of you might complain, hey, aren't there other operating systems? Why, yes, there are. And we might briefly talk about some of them, especially some of them which are substantially different. So, reasons we're talking about Unix is one, it's old. Two, a lot of operating systems imitate it in lots of ways, including other ones. And three, like, we're using a teaching OS based on it. And four, like, you can find the source code for it and, like, detailed descriptions of how it works a bit more easily than something like Windows. And most of the things we'll talk about would apply to other operating systems, too. And we'll have our standard layering. So we have our applications, which on Unix are generally written about some standard library. And we have like things that the users use, like shell commands, and we have the standard library and a bunch of utility programs, like the thing that you type your login password to. You know, that come with the machine, hopefully, or else it's hard to use. And like the shell, so you can run programs in the first place. And so one view of things is that everything, these programs, and the actual system call interface is all the operating system. So that's one thing some people will say, is that the operating system, it's the shell, it's all those programs, it's, you know, the login program, it's the standard library that all your applications use that handles actually making the system calls. Some people will say that's the operating system. Some people will say this is the operating system, that just it's just the kernel part. Neither of them are really wrong. I would usually say that the operating system includes all these utility programs and so on, Some people might say it includes some things we call applications. You know, there's a variety of opinion. But the important part is knowing like what functionality is provided here. And generally, as far as like your idea of what does it mean to program on Unix, you're thinking about actually the standard library functions. So we're going to talk about system calls, but you don't really care if everything you're doing turns into a system call or not, because you're just using that standard library like printf and so on, and somehow that works. And you don't really care what it's doing, but it clearly has to do system calls in the Unix design to actually work. Okay. So any questions about this Unix general design, these layers? Okay, so we're going to look, I mentioned earlier, at XP6. So XP6 was created by some people at MIT. And for their OS course, they originally used 6th edition Unix. So 6th edition Unix was written in the 70s, 80s, early 80s. I should actually know the date. It was written a while ago. And it was written for the PDP-11, just a little out of date. And they decided, now in the early 90s, that, you know, maybe this is getting a little awkward, like PDP assembly is kind of hard to understand, it's not, no one really uses it anymore. But gosh, we really like using a real Unix, and we have the whole source code to this. So a bunch of people there decided to re-implement it on top of x86 sometime in the late 90s, early 2000s. And in fact, they made it even be a multi-core OS that runs on 32-bit x86. So a kind of annoying thing is that this is 32-bit x86, doesn't support 64-bit, and adding 64-bit support is not something I'm going to do as a casual beginning of summer thing, because that probably is more work than that. It does support multi-core, which is pretty surprising, but apparently wasn't too hard to do. And will be helpful when we talk about dealing with multiple processors. And it's based on 6th edition Unix, but it's like, it's really minimal. Like, they've done the simplest thing, so it's only a couple thousand lines. Most of them you don't care about. Like, we're not gonna talk about how you talk to keyboards. We're just gonna say, here's some code which talks to keyboards, we're using it. Because we don't care about the details of what messages you send when and how that works. We just want it to be done for us. And the first assignment, which is either released this Friday, or if we don't cover enough that I think you're prepared to do it, the following Friday, is going to be to add to XP6 a system call. So we're going to want to add you a system call. We're calling write count. So there's a write system call, and we want you to count the number of times across all processes that the write system call is called, and make a system call to return that count. So you're adding a counter as a global variable and a function to retrieve that counter that can be called as a system call. So this is just get familiar with things. The actual code is like very tiny. And the assignment write up includes the download instructions for getting the source code. And XP6 comes with a book. So they have a book which documents everything, which is the other reason why we're using it. It's not like Linux, where you can find books on it, but like they're kind of old. And for a lot of things, like you're going to read their actual source code and say, huh, that interface changed a few over the years. And hopefully the book like covers things. So there's some technical requirements. You'll need a Linux environment. I should say, you know, VM or other environment. Hopefully we'll be able to use department login server accounts, but that's not certain yet. I'm not it. It's probably possible to do it on OS X, but you would need a cross compiler. So this is not something I recommend doing unless you feel like that's something you're willing to set up. But if someone does it and wants to give instructions, that would be great. You need a cross compiler because even though your OS X machine runs x86, need a compiler that produces object files in a different format than what OS X uses. In the Linux format for object files, not the OS X format for object files. And we're gonna use a program with this called QEMU. So QEMU is an emulator for a 32-bit x86 system. It's an actual emulator, so it doesn't, it's not a virtual machine. It actually emulates, it like runs the instruction, translates the instructions to other instructions and runs those. It has the advantage of, you know, being a bit simpler to make things work on than a virtual machine monitor like VMware. It also integrates well with GDB. So like you can run GDB on XV6 through it, even through like kernel mode stuff, which is handy. And there's a, that's the Ubuntu or Debian package, it's easy to solve. And hopefully the department login server will work, but I'm not sure we'll be able to get QEMU working on it for everyone, but hopefully. So XV6, so when you download it, it includes a bunch of things. It includes most of the things that I had in that DOS, the larger DOS bracket in the picture. So it includes a Unix-like kernel. So it has a kernel which implements some system calls, which are pretty much the sort of things you have in Unix. It's a bit less featureful, like there's no networking. There's no return codes from programs. They just exit and don't return anything. There's no failed or succeeded. And just a very small set of system calls. There's a user space library. So there's a standard library which has convenient functions for you to call that wrap the system calls. It has an implementation of printf, because you'd probably be very annoyed if it didn't, if you had to. There's only print constant strings, no formatting. So there's that in the user space library. So, but it's very limited, but it's enough that you can write things that work. And it has a bunch of user space programs. So it has a shell, it has ls, makedir, echo, cat, and a few programs for testing that things work, like that making sure spawning processes works as expected and so on. And programs in XV6 look pretty much like things you've seen. So this is the included echo program. So echo takes its arguments, prints them out. So here's the source code for it. And it looks pretty much like what you'd expect. There's some weird things, like the first argument to printf is 1. So XV6 is printf. Is not like the normal printf. Its first argument is where do you want to print to? 1 is standard output, 2 is standard error, 3 is some other file that you open. And you also notice that this ends with xset. So the standard library that comes with XV6 doesn't implement returning from main. So you have to xset. If you return from main, your program set calls. One of the things I mean by really minimal. Didn't implement that code to call main and use its return value. So questions about this? And the header files are obviously not what you're expecting from traditional Unix because they have their headers rather than the standard library. And I think and so, just to demonstrate that things work, I find the window, yeah. So here's my copy of XV6 that I've downloaded. I just clear it out so you make it. It compiles a bunch of things. And this compilation process does a lot of things that that are hard to read through. So one thing it does is that it builds the actual kernel, and the makefile has a whole bunch of options that are in fact probably needed to make the compiler work because it has to be compiled differently than normal application code. And then the applications are compiled and we have to run the linker manually for them because they're not linked like normal applications because it's a different OS. But the makefile has that all handled as far as its instructions for building programs. And also, there's this last step where you see there's a makefs command near the top of there. So it produces a file system image that contains like the actual programs because it has to use its own file disk. So you have to give it a disk. So there's something which makes a disk for it in the emulator that it can use in the emulator because it can't access the normal files. Like it can only access things on its virtual disk. So that sets this up. So in here we have C files. The .d files are used to make the makefile work. We have .asm files. So the makefile just produces the assembly versions of things, which you could get manually through a command like object dump. It just does it for you. So you can read the assembly rather than like recompiling with -s. If you want to do that, you probably don't, but it's there. It has the application. So we have underscore grep. All the user space applications start with an underscore when they're compiled, and the underscores remove when they're put on to the disk. So let's actually run this. And the command to do that is make qemu. And this gives us something like this, which will do that. And there it is. This is the emulator booting it. I have a BIOS in this emulator that comes with QEMU, which actually handles starting the OS. And here we're running the OS, so we have a shell running. We have some messages from the kernel, booting from hard disk, CPU starting zero, and open type ls. We have our directory listing. This ls is not very friendly compared to your normal ls, so it like prints the file size and a bunch, and like, forget whether it's like owner, or number of links and so on. Information you get from like ls minus l in a bad format, but we have dot, 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 readme, cat, echo, test, and so on. Like these are the files in that directory. And we can run, you know, most of these are programs, and we can run those, you know, by just typing commands. I've supplied a shutdown program, which doesn't exist in the stock XP6 distribution, believe it or not. You can't shut it down, you have to power off the emulator. If you want to not use the shutdown program, the way you do that is you try control A, you do it from the other console. But shutdown works. There. And this will say it failed because QEMU said, oh, you stopped running. That's an error, but we don't actually care. So you can also run this in Knox mode for no X. X is the windowing system on Unix. So this is non-graphical mode. So like if you were SSH into some system and wanted to run this, you can do it without displaying a separate window, in which case it just runs in your terminal. And here, so you can still do the shutdown command. You can also type control A and then a question mark to get a list of commands you can run to do things to the emulator, including notably exit the emulator. So control A, then X. Is like powering off the machine. And I believe you can do that from the console when it's running through the graphical mode, but I'm not sure. You can also close the window. And as I said, there's a book which should go through like more instructions and hopefully it will help people. And the main thing I'm worried about is just that there's the requirement for actual Linux or a cross-compiler, which probably means actual Linux because I don't have an OS X machine to tell you how to set up a cross-compiler. So any questions from that demo before I move on? Okay, so XV6, as I said, it's very simple. It has a small number of system calls, so this is probably a list of more than half of them. So it has fork, which is the way we're going to spawn new processes. We'll talk a lot more about that later. How to make a new process. Exit, to make exit a process. Wait, to wait for a program to finish an exit. Kill, to kill a program. Get PID, to get a process ID that identifies the current program that like could be passed to kill it. We have things for files, so we have open, read, write, close. Those probably make sense. Fstat is get information about a file. And dupe is make another handle to the file. We'll talk more about that next week, probably. And it has directory operations, unlink is remove, chdir is change directory. We'll talk about make, node, and link when we talk about file systems. So, but these are just general operations, and this is like half, probably more than half of the system calls it provides. So let's talk about how system calls work in XV6 in particular, since you'll have to add one. So here's the user memory part, that we have a write function that we can call directly, or typically we use like printf, and printf is going to call this write function. And this write function is what's known as a system call wrapper. And in this file, this assembly file, usys.s, after we do macro replacement, we get this global write, this write function, which moves 16 to EAX and does the system call interrupt. It doesn't use a syscall instruction, it uses int with the constant hex 40, which is just an arbitrary choice the designers of XV6 made on how the system calls are going to be made. The int instruction takes a number and runs that exception handler that the OS set up previously. They've chose that exception handler 64 hex 40 is the one we'll use for system calls. And it moves 16 to EAX to let the code which is going to handle this read that 16 and say, oh, you want to do a write rather than you want to do something else. And so we have this instruction, and this is going to turn control over to a place the kernel set up earlier. So how does the kernel do that? So there's some code in XV6, which is run on boot in the file trap.c, and it does two things. So first, it uses this lidt function. And this is a function that XV6 wrote, which wraps a privileged instruction called LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table. And this is what x86 calls the list of places that exceptions go, what code they run. It's the list of exception handlers. So we're telling the processor, hey, my list of exception handler pointers is here. Then later on, in that list, we set the entry corresponding to the system call number, which is 64. That's this tsyscall here is this constant. So we set the entry for hex 40 in that table to say that we want to run the function at vectors tsyscall, which is going to be an assembly function that we know will make system calls work correctly. And we'll show you that assembly function later. So here we're saying, I want to make system calls actually, the system call interrupt actually run the handler that I've previously written an assembly for it, so on. And there's some extra arguments here. So one part of this is that we're saying that this DPL user, and so this is setting an entry in that table, telling the processor, hey, it's okay for this to be triggered from user mode. If we didn't set that, when we ran that int hex 40 instruction, instead of getting a normal exception handler running, it would get the handler for a protection fault, for your program did something bad. And we'd rather use the normal exception handler. And that's what that's saying to do. Otherwise, we get the handler for the same handler we get for like accessing a null pointer would run, which we could handle, but that would be a lot of extra work to figure out, is this a null pointer access really, or is it actually a system call? So instead we have the system call separated into this other handler. we have this argument which says to use the kernel code segment when you run this handler. And this is on x86, how you say, hey, this exception handler should run in kernel mode. Bizarrely, you can have them not run in kernel mode. I don't know why you'd ever want to do that. In fact, x86 will never do that, but that's an option, and this is how we tell x86, no, really, I want it to run in kernel mode. It's part of the OS, please run it in kernel mode. It also does some other things, because it's a code segment, but nothing we care about. And this is a pointer to a function called vector64 that's written in assembly, included with the xv6 source code. So let me show you the source to vector64 and a whole bunch of related functions. So this is what we actually set that pointer that the processor is using to. So when we run, so back here, when we're here, that this is going to the CPU, that's convenient, will jump to vector 64. So that's the actual effect of this, is that int instruction. Because we set up that pointer, it's going to jump to vector 64 in kernel mode. And that is the confusing effect of this line. So vector 64, this is running in kernel mode. Its first thing it does is it pushes 0, then 64 on the stack, then jumps to this function all traps, and eventually this ends up calling a C function called trap. So I'm not going to go through the detail of how the assembly code works, but what it's doing is just setting up this call to the C function. So just a whole bunch of work to call the C function and set up that argument, that struct trap frame, to have the values we expect it to have. And in particular, that struct trap frame is going to contain all the save registers and all the information about the system call. So it's going to have the value of EAX is going to be in there, the value of the stack pointer where we can find the other arguments to the system call is going to be there, the number 0 and 64 is going to be there that was pushed on the stack. That's all going to be accessible through that structure. And the C code is going to examine that and decide what to do, and hopefully it's going to decide, oh, this is a write, I'm going to do a write. So questions so far, since a lot of people look confused. Yes?
What was the 16?
So question is, what is the 16 that we have here represent? It's a number we've chosen to represent write versus something like exit. So it's distinguishing what kind of system call are we doing. Is it a write? Is it an exit? Is it a read? You just have to have some marker for that. And your question?
Same question.
Okay. People are back here. Okay, yeah, that 16, we just needed the constant to say this is a write and not a read. So you have to put that information somewhere. Other questions? Yes?
Isn't that what the insert 64 doing though?
Sorry, isn't?
Isn't that what the vector 64 is doing though?
So the question is, we have this 64, we have this table with at least 64 entries. Why don't we just have a separate interrupt number for each, for write, read, etc.? Like, doesn't that already handle that? And the answer is yes. This is a choice we could have made, is instead of having that value in EAX saying this is a write, we could say that write is interrupt hex 40, read is interrupt hex 41, and so on. And in fact, there are operating systems which do that. xv6 has chosen that all system calls use the same instruction to enter kernel mode. This is an arbitrary choice that they made that they didn't have to make. But you're right, that would be a sensible thing to do. And in fact, it is what the x86 table of exception handlers is designed to support. But like many operating systems on x86, we're going to ignore that functionality and only use one entry of the table, basically. And this is a very common thing, like pretty much every modern x86 operating system does this. just because they felt it was easier to have their own way of numbering system calls rather than trying to interact with the processor's way of doing it. But you're right that this does seem like it's designed that we can just specify write in the int instruction. And in like DOS, that's what actually happens. So, other questions? Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, I said after macro replacement, so is this generated? So this assembly file is an assembly file which has pound defines. And this is after you expand the pound define. So it is a little less easy to read, but easier to write when you add a system call, because you don't have to write all the boilerplate, you just write, there's a system call called X, and it will fill in the rest. So we have this function trap that we're calling with this argument tf, which represents the registers that we saved and the information about this system call. And so in that C function, the first thing it does is says, okay, is the track number, is the type of interrupt I got, is it the system call one? Which is checking, was this int hex 40? That's where that if statement is checking. And if so, we handle the system call. So we have a few steps here. And notably, this is working because, you know, this trap frame, it has the interrupt type, it has the application registers. So we're reading that, figure out first, is it a system call? And if it's a system call, we do a bunch of things with this myproc thing. So what's myproc? So myproc is this function, which you can think of as kind of like a global variable. It retrieves the currently running process on the CPU we're on. Whatever processor we're on, it says what process is running, it figures out what that is based on what CPU we're on. And we'll talk more about that later. And like what this thing it returns contains, because it's obviously a struct with lots of fields, and we're like looking at one of them. Like there's a killed field. If the process is killed and made a system call, we don't want to let it run the system call, we just want to kill it. We have an exit. And then we set this TF member, this trap frame member of the process, for the system call to use, and we make call the syscall function. So in the syscall function, which actually implements the syscall, we're going to read the TF member of myproc to look up the registers and figure out what were the arguments to the system call, because that's all going to be saved in there. So it just uses that to determine what to actually do, and afterwards we return, and where we return to is going to eventually execute that special instruction to go back to user mode. So what does this syscall function do? So the syscall function, it looks up the EAX register that was saved when we had the interrupt happen, and uses that to figure out, hey, what system call number are we running? And it looks up in a table to find the syswrite function, which implements the write system call. So we have this array of functions, one per syscall. This is in fact some special C syntax to set element called sys underscore write equal value when you're initializing the array. And we just call that function through the pointer to the function. And that actually implements the system call. And notice that we assign the return value to the EAX register, because that's where, in the calling convention, our return value goes. So it returns an integer, that's where we put the integer. So when we restore the registers for the user program, they can look in EAX and say, did my write succeed? By reading the EAX register we restored for them. And in the syswrite function that we call, we have these utility functions which get our arguments. And the way those work is those just look in myproc tf and read the stack to find the arguments. This is 32-bit x86, so the arguments are on the stack and not in registers. So they were just reading from the stack using the stack pointer that was stored there. And then we execute the actual internal function that implements it, and so on. So I have a little more of this to go through, but I think I shouldn't go over time too much. So we'll finish that up next time. Pretty close to the end.